there would be no guarantee I'd pass the trials. After all, even Kai, with his staggering speed, agility and power, had somehow failed his first attempt. Which meant I needed a backup plan. Pernilius's book could very well be in the library at the school, but I wouldn't gain access to it unless I passed the trials. So I had to explore other paths to knowledge. I made a point of speaking to the masters during my breaks from training, hoping to find Sudija's version of Brother Thistle. Surely one of them knew of a scholar whose favourite pastime was burying himself under piles of decaying volumes and musty scrolls. My tentative questions all led me to the same answer. Master Dalla was a keen student of history. He was the one to speak to if I had any questions on esoteric knowledge. The problem was that Master Dalla had the friendly demeanour of a locked vault and the approachability of a sea-worn cliff. I could bash myself against his jagged exterior for hours on end, and all I would get was a headache. Small talk yielded nothing. When direct questions about his love of history didn't work, I moved on to flattery. When that failed, I attempted charm, which was awkward for everyone. Kai winced at my eagerness. He began to tease me about hero-worshipping the legendary master until I walloped him, flipping him onto his back in the school courtyard in a cloud of dust. He, of course, grinned. The most I could glean from all my efforts was that the library did indeed house the most rare and valuable of the kingdom's manuscripts, and without exception, only the masters were admitted entry. When the week of training was over, I was gripped by a sense of inevitability, underpinned by panic. I could no longer tell myself that I'd find the book without committing myself to any vows. Only as a master would I be trusted with the knowledge I needed. The night before the first trial, Kai and I were invited to dine with the Queen. We entered the Great Hall, a spacious room on the second floor of the South Tower, with embroidered silk curtains in warm colours, and bronze hanging lamps with lacy openings that blazed with light. The highly polished wood table reflected the lamps, throwing an extra glow onto the colourful porcelain plates and glass goblets. Side tables topped in mosaic tiles were covered with fragrant dishes, emitting the scent of roasted meat and unfamiliar spices. The Queen sat at one end of the main table, and Prince Iko sat at her right. Though the setting was rich and stately, the atmosphere seemed intimate. It struck me as less formal than dinners in the Frost Court. With help from a lady's maid named Ada, I dressed in a white gown with gold lace covering the bodice, borrowed from the overstuffed wardrobe of some fireblood lady of the court. Kai, with clothing that had clearly been tailored just for him, was a study in masculine perfection, in a cream doublet over fawn trousers and black knee boots. Queen Nalani wore a wine-coloured silk dress and a heavy gold filigree crown, while Prince Iko wore loose robes in navy blue. Her lips curved in the hint of a smile, but her expression remained as watchful as ever. I dropped into a curtsy, my palms damp against my skirt.
"You may rise, Ruby,"
she said in Tempesian, surprising me with both her fluency and her willingness to speak the language, presumably as a courtesy to me.
"Good evening, Prince Kai."
She invited Kai to sit at her left side, and for me to sit next to him. As Kai pulled out my chair for me, Prince Iko stood politely. I took a second to examine him more closely. His sable hair was streaked with hints of white, his narrow but handsome face just beginning to soften at the jawline. My attention was arrested by his eyes, a bright shade of leaf green. They seemed to be fixed on the left side of my face, which made my scar feel unaccountably warm. I rubbed it briefly to ease the sting. As he bowed, he towered over the table. I realized he was perhaps the tallest person I'd ever met, his height accentuated by his lean, almost skinny frame. I curtsied again and took the seat that Kai held out for me, glad to have the table to hide the fact that I couldn't stop bouncing my knee. I didn't know why I was so nervous. The Queen had decided to let me take the trials. As long as I didn't come at her with a fish fork, I didn't think she would change her mind. A footman poured the wine, which tasted fruity and smooth, but strong. I would have to be careful only to sip it. The Queen and Prince Iko made small talk with Kai as dinner was served, plate after plate of artfully arranged dishes laden with fish, sweet potatoes, pork, rice, and a variety of fruit. I took an experimental bite of a yellow fruit, blinking in surprise at the strong taste, both tart and sugary. The Queen chose that moment to turn her attention to me. "How's your training progressing, Ruby?"
"She learns quickly," said Kai before I could answer. "And she knows more than I expected. Perhaps almost as much as an initiate after 2 or 3 years of training."
My brows rose at that. He'd seldom praised me, not in actual words. But the Queen continued to look at me expectantly, obviously wanting me to answer as well. As if my answer mattered, which was an about-face from the last time we'd met. Yet her demeanour was surprisingly warm now. Perhaps this was the face she wore for special occasions, or perhaps she wanted me to let down my guard. Did I dare to hope that I had earned some respect for doing well in my training? She had said her fireblood masters were vital. If I passed, I would be important to her, to the entire kingdom. The idea sent a little buzz of satisfaction through me. I had to remind myself that I wasn't here to please the Queen. I had my own agenda. I patted the edges of my lips with a snowy napkin. "Kai is a good teacher." "But not a patient one, I reckon," said Prince Iko with a twinkle in his eye. "The young prince isn't known for his calm nature."
"A true fireblood," said the Queen proudly. "Though I have told him before that his impulsiveness could well be his downfall, as it has been before."
Kai inclined his head.
"And yet, you've been gracious enough to allow me a second chance."
"Do not fail me this time," she said.
His face grew serious.
"I won't."
A footman came forward and refilled our goblets, the crystal reflecting the glow from an enormous fireplace rimmed in black marble. It was strange to think that in northern Tempesia, the first snows would already be weighing down the pine boughs. The Queen must have noticed me staring at the fire.
"It's symbolic," she said, taking a sip of her wine. "A fire always burns in the formal rooms of my palace. Night and day, summer or winter, sun or storm. The flame eternal, like the spirits of the fireblood people. Crush us, beat us. Cut us down. We will not be extinguished. We live in the embers and rise again to consume our enemies."
"That's," I searched for the right response, "very apt."
"Do you believe it to be true?"
Her warm, dark eyes fixed on me. "I hope so, Your Majesty. The Firebloods in Tempesia were driven away or killed. I like to think we'll thrive there again one day.
As it happens, I share your dream."
I froze with my goblet halfway to my mouth.
"You want Firebloods to return to Tempesia?" "My islands are many, but the total land is small compared to the kingdom north of the vast sea."
Prince Iko swirled the wine in his goblet.
"Tempesia has inferior soil and a harsh climate."
The Queen inclined her head.
"Except for the Aris Plains, which are fertile. When Firebloods began settling in Tempesia, it was still sparsely populated in the south. We brought our farming methods, tilling virgin soil and building homes. You know this, of course."
She raised a brow at me.
"Yes, Your Majesty." "We kept the early frosts from crops, effectively lengthening the growing season. We shared our shipbuilding, our navigation methods. We helped shape that kingdom and, for a time, we worked and lived with them in relative peace. Now they've taken our lands in the south, and Firebloods were disposed of so the Frostbloods could reap the benefits of our labour. I will fight for our right to these prosperous lands once again."
It was unclear how she meant to fight for those rights, though. Sudesia, with its smaller population,
couldn't possibly hope to take the lands by force. Her lips curved.
You wonder why I'm giving you this history lesson?
I did wonder, but it would be rude to admit that. So I practiced my diplomatic skills.
I find history fascinating. My mother and grandmother taught me some, but there's much I don't know. For instance, I don't know the history of the Frostbloods living in Sudesia. One of my...
I wondered what to call Brother Thistle, settling on the simplest description.
Friends is a Frostblood who left here when he was a child.
Her expression cooled. The idea of a Frostblood as my friend probably stretched her imagination to its limits.
In any case, let me return to my history, she continued. Akul was crowned king, and some say he was driven mad by the murder of his queen by Fireblood rebels.
She leaned forward.
He set out to destroy my people in revenge. So let me ask you this. Why did he not sail across the vast sea to conquer my lands?
Because of the Strait of Akkadens, I replied.
And the masters who guard it, she clarified.
They are the true jewels of the land.
Never forget that, should you pass the trials. You will serve as my best defense against attack. Our power lies in unity, not as individuals. My people in Tempesia had no such protection.
You still considered them your people? I asked. Firebloods who no longer live in Sudesia.
Firebloods have always been my people, whether they left Sudesia 4 days or 4 centuries ago.
She gripped the stem of her goblet, her dark brows winging down over her fierce gaze.
We lost many ships, many loyal soldiers, in our attempts to save your compatriots from Rasmus's decree that they should be killed or brought to his arena. Though we were able to save some, most were lost. It is the greatest tragedy in the history of my people. And it happened during my reign. I will not rest until my people are in Tempesia again.
Her knuckles turned white, her fingers tightening until the crystal stem snapped with an audible crunch.
I gasped aloud before I could stifle it. The look in her eyes was murderous.
A footman came and carefully whisked the broken pieces away. A full goblet soon replaced the broken one. No one batted an eye. Perhaps the queen broke crystal on a regular basis.
Again, I wondered if the Minax was possessing the queen. I checked my senses for any sign of it, but found none, aside from a tingle on the back of my neck, which could merely be nerves.
My eyes were drawn to her wrist to check the colour of the vein, but her long sleeves kept me from confirming whether it was a natural red or the inky black of possession. I sipped my wine and tried not to show how much her unbridled fury had shaken me. She was passionate, but with that came unpredictable behaviour. It was a reminder that my current freedom was based on her whims.
You alone were blessed by Sud to survive the massacre of our people, Ruby.
I met her eyes as she added, Your mother, I heard, was not so fortunate. I clasped my hands tightly in my lap, my stomach lurching.
That's right. I'm sincerely sorry, she said.
Thank you. I cast my eyes downward. My hands were trembling and cold. This conversation had gone on far too long, and I just wanted it to end.
But let us return to more pleasant matters.
She sipped and asked smoothly,
Prince Kai, has your aunt found a suitable bride for you yet?
Though a change in subject was welcome, it was startlingly abrupt, and it didn't seem like this was a pleasant topic for Kai. He had the look of a cornered rabbit as he replied,
Aunt Isla understands that I do not wish to rush into marriage. I am barely 18 summers, Your Majesty.
It surprised me that we were almost the same age. All that restless swagger made Kai seem older, especially since he was so confident as captain of his ship. Then again, Arcus was king, and he wasn't much older. His serious demeanour always made him seem more than a few years my senior.
Indeed, but the most powerful among us have a duty to produce heirs, you know. It's good to start young. You have seen how it's with me. I cannot have children, and the succession is now uncertain. Kai paused for several moments.
I will give the matter serious consideration, Your Majesty.
Perhaps since your mother is no longer alive and your aunt has not found the right woman, I may be of assistance in finding you a bride.
His eyes widened. I stifled a laugh at his expression, relieved the conversation had lightened.
You're most generous, he muttered,
downing his drink. The plates were cleared and dessert was served, tiny iced cakes and tarts filled with sweet berries and cream. In what I deemed a transparent attempt to ward off any further talk of nuptials, Kai carried the conversation, steering it into neutral territory. I pasted on an interested expression and tuned everyone out, mentally reviewing my plans.
You have much on your mind, Prince Aiko said, leaning forward across the table and speaking in a low voice so as not to interrupt Kai's conversation with the Queen. I hoped the worry hadn't shown on my face. He added,
You must be nervous about your trials.
Yes, a little, I admitted,
glad that I had a reasonable excuse for anxiety.
I'm sorry if I was inattentive.
He waved away the apology.
It's only natural. Anyone would be preoccupied on such a night. And it's difficult not knowing what to expect, isn't it?
He glanced at the Queen, who was still engaged in conversation with Kai, and leaned in further.
I can tell you a few things without breaking any oaths, if you'd like.
Please, I said, wondering why he would want to help me. What did he have to gain? He pressed his fingers together, reminding me a bit of Brother Thistle when he was about to give a lecture.
Each trial tests a different ability, so the first, second, and third trial are all quite different from each other.
They're meant to push you to your limits so that only the strongest of firebloods will have a chance of passing.
However, strength of the gift does not guarantee success. There are other factors that come to bear on your success or failure.
What kind of factors? I asked.
Some of them are physical, like endurance, agility, or skill. Some things are mental, such as adaptability and perseverance. Your will, your decisions, can play a large role in the trials.
Suddenly, I noticed the table had fallen silent. I glanced up to see the Queen watching Prince Aiko.
You come very close to revealing too much, my dear, she said in silken tones. She will find out more tomorrow, and that is soon enough, I think.
Prince Aiko sat back, looking chagrined.
Of course. Best of luck tomorrow, Ruby, Queen Nalani said as she rose to her feet.
Prince Aiko, Kai, and I stood as well.
Thank you, Your Majesty, I replied with a curtsy, when a question occurred to me.
Your Majesty, when you were telling me your history, you never mentioned what happened to the Frostbloods living in Sudesia. Perhaps next time you can tell me more.
She smiled, but it was cold, as if it were ice and not fire that ran through her veins.
My child, I assumed you knew. When it was clear that my people in Tempesia were lost to me, I rounded up all the Frostbloods living in my kingdom. Some of them became indentured servants, like my loyal Rhaenyra.
She gestured to one of the footmen standing against the wall, and I blinked hard. How had I missed that? His eyes were a pale greyish-blue, subtle, but definitely the mark of a Frostblood.
And the ones who refused to go into service? I asked curiously, forcing myself not to stare.
She captured my gaze, her irises as cold and opaque as prison walls.
I ordered my Fireblood masters to execute them all.
Chapter 13 That night, I was pacing the plush, richly patterned carpet in my room when a soft knock sounded at my door. I opened it to see Kai, still dressed, a cup in each hand.
May I come in?
Conscious of the thin fabric of my nightgown, crossed my arms over my chest and backed up. I suppose. Can't sleep? He asked, shutting the door with his foot. I shrugged.
Neither could I the night before my first trial.
He held out a cup. To ease your nerves.
Is this tea or wine? I need to be sharp tomorrow.
Which means you need sleep. Just a few drops.
I sighed and took the cup. He clinked his against mine.
To becoming a master.
Are we toasting you or me?
He grinned.
Both. All was darkness outside the glow of my single candle. The emptiness pressed against us as if it wanted to swallow us whole. For all I knew, this night was my last. The last time I'd feel the comfort of a bed. The last time I'd dream my dreams and think about the person I cared for most in this world. I'd written a letter to Arcus after dinner, telling him things I'd never had the courage to say to his face. Hot tears had fallen, making a mess of the ink and sizzling tiny holes in the parchment. I hope he'd forgive me. For that and for everything else. I pushed the thoughts of Arcus away, at least as much as I could. He was never far from my mind.
You're confident I'll pass then?
I asked, my stomach knotting. I recognized the nerves. They were the same I'd felt every time I had to enter King Rasmus's arena. He gave me a reproving look.
I wouldn't have wasted my time this week if I thought you couldn't pass.
Not as reassuring as I'd hoped, but maybe that was high praise from Kai. After all, he'd failed at least one of the tests.
Did you pass the first trial?
Of course. I passed the first two trials, which is why I don't have to retake them.
He took a drink and then stared at his cup, swirling it gently. I watched his dense lashes, several shades darker than his hair, cast shadows on his cheeks. He looked almost melancholy, which was so unusual for him that my heart squeezed a little. I took another sip.
Do you ever consider how cruel the trials are? They're risking the lives of anyone who isn't strong enough. I see little difference between this and the Frost King's arena.
The trials are a choice, he said defensively. No one is forced to take them. There are ways out of the first trial for anyone who realizes they're not strong enough to finish.
He snapped his mouth closed, as if realizing he'd said too much.
However, if you leave, you forfeit, and you'll never be allowed to take them again.
Unless I bargain with the Queen like you did.
Oh, wait, you're the exception to all rules. I forced a smile. Indeed.
He lifted his goblet to me in acknowledgement, his lips curving, then drained it and set the goblet down.
Well, I suppose I should let you get some sleep. I don't want to be the reason you're fatigued on the most important day of your life.
Before you go, I have a favour to ask. I went to my dressing table and picked up the rolled-up parchment. If I don't make it out of my trial, I'd like you to make sure this gets back to Tempesia. Kai frowned at the scroll.
To whom?
Arcus, I said simply. He frowned and didn't move to take the letter.
Just get it to him.
I pressed it into his hand. It's a last request. You do honour last requests here, don't you?
We try.
Thank you. I paused.
I'd appreciate if you didn't read it.
He looked offended.
I wouldn't do that.
I nodded, feeling a little awkward, though I didn't know why. We stood in silence for a few moments more.
You will pass tomorrow, he said, his eyes bright with warmth. Just stay calm. Remember your training.
I tipped my cup, drank in a series of gulps, and offered it, empty, to Kai. Thanks for the drink. Craving oblivion, I turned and crawled into bed to settle under the covers.
Sleep well, little bird, he said,
shutting the door with a quiet click. The carriage wheels creaked in the pre-dawn hush, depositing Kai and me at the school as sunrise bruised the sky. Master Dalla waited in the entryway. As we came closer, he held up one calloused palm to Kai, who halted beside me. Kai took my hands briefly in his. He looked at Master Dalla and then bent to my ear.
Lava will burn the flesh of your bones, you or any fireblood. Don't hesitate. Don't look back.
I looked at him sharply. My already elevated pulse sped up even more. Was he breaking his oath by telling me something about the trial? His gaze was dark, intense. I dipped my chin to show him I'd taken note. His fingers tightened before letting go. I turned and followed the Fireblood Master without looking back. My stomach was a tight knot of nerves, but my mind was clear and determined. Instead of entering the school, Master Dalla veered onto flagstones leading around the side of the building, then to a scrubby footpath that climbed a steep, rocky hill. As we crested it, the sun's rim peeked over the horizon, casting a pink glow over the undulating sea and the smudges of distant islands. He gestured toward the shadowy bulk of a small building of grey stone. When we reached inside, I saw a life-size statue of Sued holding a bowl of fire. The master knelt and pressed his forehead to the floor, and I did the same, mouthing a quick prayer. As he knelt, a chain slid from the collar of his robe and clunked against the floor. A black key hung from the end of it. The key to the library! My fingers itched to reach out and grab it. But that would be far too obvious. I reminded myself I needed more than just the right book in my hands. I needed to conquer my powers as well. I wanted to become a master, not just for the sake of finding out how to destroy the Minax, but to prove I could do it when the time came. He straightened and tucked the key back into his robe. We left the temple and descended the hill where lava fields spread out below, barren and black with rough ridges like petrified waves. Plants grew from cracks and crevices, leafy ferns and saplings, bright green against the black. In the distance, a volcano spewed white smoke from its grey mouth, a dragon belching into the sky, vegetation clinging to its shoulders like bright green scales. We reached the ruins of a stone wall. Black rock was pooled against and around it, as if frozen in the act of trying to storm the walls. I followed Master Dalla through a broken archway, a remnant of the destroyed building, and continued for another minute or two. He stopped and gestured to the ground, then bowed low and turned away. "I'm supposed to go in here." I peered into an inky black hole, then looked up. Master Dalla was already several yards away. He didn't look back. I slid in feet first, lowering myself slowly, palms grating against the sides of a narrow shaft. I lost control, sliding for a few seconds before I landed hard on my hands and knees. Kai's warning had put me on guard. I looked around quickly, sighing with relief that there was no lava in sight. Just torches lining the black stone walls of a tunnel, which tilted down into darkness. The torchlight illuminated markings carved into the walls and ceiling. A swirl here, a diamond shape there, three curving lines underscored by a horizontal slash. I didn't know whether they were writing or art, but they did look familiar. I'd seen similar designs carved into the ice columns of Arcus's castle, most notably in the throne room. Come to think of it, I'd seen a few at Forwind Abbey, too. I'd figured they were common frostblood motifs, something to do with fours. How they made their way into a tunnel under the lava fields of the Sudesian capital, I had no idea. Not far along, a wooden slab with the markings of a door blocked the tunnel, its bulk completely filling the space. A ladder hung a few feet before the door, leading up to a shaft above. That must be one of the ways out that Kai had mentioned. I ignored the ladder and pushed at the wood. Then, when it didn't budge, put my ear close and knocked. It gave a hollow echo. I stood for a moment, calculating. I didn't think the test was supposed to be a great mystery. The door was made of wood. My gift was fire. It seemed logical I was meant to use it. Kai had said not to hesitate. I burned through the door in less than a minute, careful to create a space only big enough to get through. I didn't want to exhaust myself unnecessarily. I walked quickly down the passage past another ladder until a second slab of wood loomed before me in the darkness, a little thicker than the last. It took over a minute to burn through. By the fourth door, I started to lose track of time. My breaths came faster. My limbs felt heavier. I'd just burned through the sixth, much thicker door, when a loud grinding sound came from behind. The tunnel filled with heat. I turned to see a glowing ooze that changed shape as it slid down the incline behind me. So that's what Kai had meant when he told me lava would burn the flesh of a fireblood's bones. My pulse jerked frantically. I hurried to the next door, this time burning the upper portion only before climbing through the gap, leaving the lower portion as a barrier against the lava. I might need some extra seconds later. I arrived at the seventh door. It was maybe twice as thick as the previous one. The passage widened here, and a shaft of sunlight lit the space. Another ladder. It was far more tempting to climb now, but that wasn't an option. I bent my attention to the door, pulling the heat from my chest and sending it through my arms, fire exploding from my palms into the wood. It splintered and crackled. When the hole was large enough, I hauled myself through, trembling and winded, and looked back as I held myself suspended in the opening. A pinpoint of glowing orange, still far, moved closer. I calculated that it must have crossed the barrier of the first, and perhaps the second door. With a final glance at the ladder, I dropped to the floor and rushed on. After a grueling battle with the eighth door, the lava felt close, the heat rising with each harsh, uneven breath. Fatigue weighted my arms. I shook it off and pushed forward. No ladder hung next to the ninth door, although a narrow opening punctured the stone ceiling, admitting buttery rays of light. A shadow passed over it. A master watching, perhaps, or just a cloud passing over the sun. The thick door yielded the dullest of thuds when I knocked on it. I took two short breaths and made a concentrated flame. I groaned as I held the flame steady, eyes closed, all my will aimed into the wood. Scorch marks blackened the door, but it was otherwise unharmed. I took a breath and tried again, recalling my training. Focus. Don't hold back. Build the heat. Let it burn. Hotter. Hotter. More. My whole body trembled. I called up hot fear, burning hatred, the searing thirst for revenge. I allowed myself memories usually kept at bay. The night when the soldiers came to my village, their faces like nightmarish spirits in the glow of the burning buildings. But when I pictured the face of the captain who killed my mother, another image came with it. Mother's body crumpling to the snow. Pain lashed my heart, like a candle burned down to its base. My fire sputtered. No. Focus. Tired. Heat. Tired. Exhaustion pulled at every muscle and sinew. My legs shook. I grabbed at the door to keep from falling. Hissing came from behind. Fiery liquid poured through the opening in the eighth door, devouring the wood until only the upper edges remained. Lava pooled and oozed like a glowing oil spill. Panic replenished my heat, like adding fresh coal to a forge. I poured my fire into the door and burned a few inches away, the edges blackening under my fire. When the depth of the hole reached about 2 feet, a tiny point of light appeared. I shoved my finger through it and felt a rush of elation. The heat from the approaching lava suddenly singed the backs of my calves. Acting on instinct, I turned and threw my hands out, the way I would to control flames. The lava stopped. Just stopped. As if an invisible barrier held it back. But how? Sage? I whispered. I waited for a vision of the golden-eyed woman who sometimes appeared to me,
but I couldn't see her, nor hear her voice. Still, she must have intervened. Relief and gratitude brought another surge of strength. I screamed as I poured the last bit of my heat into the door. The edges of the opening burst into flame, the space widening. I pulled my legs up, away from the motionless lava, and wiggled feet first into the breach. As I hoisted myself through, my hips stuck in the narrow gap. I swore fiercely and braced my elbows on the sides. Then a final heave ripped gashes into my tunic and leggings. My feet hit the ground. I looked back through the opening to see the lava moving again. Two tunnels led downward to the left and right, but ahead, the passage rose. I ran up the incline, the torches blurring at the edges of my vision. A minute later, I burst through into the sunlight. I collapsed onto the ground and saw that I was on the far side of the hill, overlooking the school, the temple to Sud casting shadows in the morning sun. I panted, lying on my back while clouds and seagulls cut white shapes into the blue. My head spun with relief, and just a touch of pride. I'd passed the first Fireblood trial. I was one step closer to learning how to destroy the Minux. Kai came to my room again that night. This time he brought sweets, tiny iced cakes in a rainbow of colours.
To celebrate the passing of your first trial.
I carefully lifted a pink confection with a tiny chocolate leaf on top. I was still giddy that I'd passed. Everything seemed possible. Suddenly, even the idea of mastering my gift and beating the Minax was within reach. The only thing tempering my euphoria was the knowledge that Sage must have intervened to help me. After all, who else could have saved me from death by lava at the last second? And if she intervened, I must have been in real trouble. She'd never helped me so directly before. But I shoved the thought away. I wanted to bask in the elation of my win.
I love sweets, I said, around a glorious mouthful of cake. I know, Kai said dryly. You were covered in powdered sugar the night we met.
He smiled almost wistfully, as if that happened years ago instead of weeks.
I had you pegged as a traitor to our people, or, at the very least, an opportunist who cared for nothing but your own ambition. Though the Queen had sent me to recruit you, I didn't have much hope that you'd remain loyal.
I swallowed my bite. I'm assuming you've changed your mind, otherwise it would be rude to mention that.
I might have cause to re-examine my thinking.
He seized a tiny cake and popped it into his mouth. I dusted sugar from my fingertips, then selected another, white with blue piping. After eating a few more, I put a hand to my stomach.
I shouldn't have eaten so many.
Or maybe I'm just getting nervous about the next trial. He put the tray on a side table.
Climb in bed and I'll tuck you in.
I crossed my arms. Again, I'm not a child.
Well, you look like one at the moment. Could they have fit any more ruffles on this nightgown?
I looked down. My nightgown was, indeed, covered in ruffles, one of which Kai flicked with an extended index finger. He transferred the touch to my chin and smiled. My cheeks heated. I turned away and crawled into bed. It seemed safer than standing in the candlelight in a semi-sheer nightgown. I didn't want him to leave yet. It was nice to have company to take the edge off my anxiety about the second trial. "Tell me a story," I said, with sudden inspiration, "like you did on the ship." He laughed.
"I thought you didn't want to be treated like a child. You sound just like Ava."
He came and sat on the edge of the bed.
"What do you want to hear, then?"
"Continue the one you were telling, about the birth of the wind gods.
Gyrus had just been banished."
"Ah."
He cleared his throat.
"Well, Neb and Tempest barely had time to grieve for their son's betrayal when Neb found that she was expecting again. She gave birth to twins, Sud and Fors, who were equally matched in every way. As they grew, they loved to hunt. Cirrus would follow her younger siblings to make sure they weren't injured by the animals that had spread across the world. But she also felt sorry for the animals, and often saved them,
mending their cuts and pouring life back into their broken bodies.
A convenient ability,
I observed, covering another yawn. Indeed, and not just for the animals. Sometimes she healed her younger siblings from cuts and bruises and broken limbs. Sued and Fours were fearless and curious, getting into scrapes and risking themselves for the sheer joy of facing danger, much like someone in this room.
You must be talking about yourself. I'm the soul of caution, he chuckled.
As they explored the world, they found the broken dolls Eurus had discarded as a child. Together they fixed them and breathed life into them. They grew fascinated by these creatures, whom they called men and women. For a while, the twins worked in harmony to help people in small ways, teaching them how to hunt and cook the meat with fire.
I said. My eyes had fallen closed. Kai stroked my hair. It felt so nice I didn't bat his hand away, and continued.
But Fours and Sued grew bored of watching people do the same things day after day, and decided to explore. They travelled east and found a young man who looked like them. He said he was their brother, Eurus, and that he was tired of living all alone.
I shivered and pulled the quilt higher over my shoulder.
They brought Eurus back to their parents' dwelling, which was built high in the clouds so that Neb could be close to her first daughter, the sun. We have found our brother, they said, and we want you to let him come home. At first Tempest refused, but the twins said, do as we ask, or we will leave and never return. So Neb and Tempest had no choice but to embrace their oldest son. In gratitude, Eurus wove palm fronds into fans and gave them to the twins. Fors used his fan to create the north wind, and Sued created the south wind.
And Sirius joined them in a game that tumbled winds across the world, and all four siblings laughed in great joy.
I smiled serenely, imagining myself as a wind god floating on the currents I'd made with my fan.
But their games had caused havoc over the earth, creating typhoons and hurricanes and tornadoes. Sun looked down upon the people and saw that her siblings had destroyed simple homes and crops they had started to grow, and she shone a light on the destruction. And Cirrus saw what her sister, Sun, was showing her, and she told her other siblings to stop their game.
Did they stop? I asked drowsily. Grandmother had told me this story, but it was so long ago, I didn't recall the details.
They did, all but Eurus. Why, those people are nothing but the dolls I broke as a child, he said, laughing at their pathetic fragility. And he made wind after rushing wind and laughed as it swept people and animals into clouds of dust, wiping the land clean. You are cruel, said Cirrus, shaking with rage, and you have no regard for life. You are foolish and weak, said Eurus, and you care too much for small, broken things. I am stronger than you, she said.
Eurus said, then let us see who will win a contest of strength.
Kai's warm hand cupped my shoulder. Ruby? I tried to reply, but I was floating in the clouds. With one more stroke over my hair, his hand left me, and I felt the bed move as he stood. Good night, he whispered. That night, I was back in the Frost King's castle, in my old room with the heavy curtains, richly upholstered chairs, and the table piled with books in front of a darkened window. The room was lit by a single candle that sat on a table next to the bed. I slid out from under the covers, my feet landing on soft carpet. Strangely, the air was warm, scented with hibiscus and bougainvillea. I paused a moment, breathing in. A book lay at my feet. As I picked it up, it fell open to a picture of a throne room that looked like one of Sister Pastel's illuminations at the Abbey, painted with charcoal and scarlet and tints of cerulean blue. The throne was mostly black, with veins of red and vermilion running through it, and icy pillars all around. The walls were a mix of stone and crackling frost. A sapphire ring glinted on one armrest of the throne,
while the ruby ring glinted on the other. I closed the book and put it on the bed before leaving my room, breathing softly as I wandered the empty hallways.
"This way," a voice whispered.
I followed it, my hands brushing the walls. Suddenly, I was no longer in the king's castle, but the queen's. The walls of black stone. I found myself at a set of double doors opening into a cavern with black pillars and sputtering torches, a throne in the center casting a dull red glow. I could feel its heat pressing against me, beckoning and warning, hinting at a power that couldn't be fully contained. The Fire Throne. It was so beautiful. Sood had created this, and I could feel the goddess's own heat searing the air. Hot, bubbling lines of molten lava ran continuously through the black stone, small air bubbles forming and bursting, each tiny vein glowing. Could even a fireblood bear to sit on that relentless heat? It was hard to see the full shape of the throne in this light, but it looked somewhat irregular, the two armrests slightly uneven. I stepped closer and reached out, placing my hand on one arm. There was a long, breathy sigh. My hand slid farther up the surface of the rock. It was hot, but not unbearable. My whole body warmed. I moved closer until my legs brushed the throne's base. Heat travelled up to my belly and into my chest, through my arms and out my fingers back into the throne. It felt as if I were part of it, drawing from its energy source and giving back in equal measure. Suddenly, I sensed a pressure under my skin, and a consciousness that was not my own examining the feel of my form, curious and searching, like a bird that visits a newfound nest. I realized I'd been holding my breath, and exhaled a mouthful of air. I squeezed my eyes shut and tried to find the light inside myself, to expel the presence inside my skin.
"Ruby," the man's voice said, "what are you doing?"
My eyes flew open, but all I could see was a tall, shadowy figure, with only dim light coming through an open door. We were in a dusty storage room filled with broken baskets, sagging shelves, and piles of firewood.
"Where did the throne go?" I whispered.
The form moved closer, a warm hand finding mine.
"You're not really awake, are you, Ruby? Come, I'll take you back to your room."
With those words, I felt the dark presence shift, felt its reluctance as it flowed out of me, leaving me limp and shaking. Chapter 14. A wooden bridge with rope cables spanned two cliff faces. Lava poured from one cliff like a waterfall, gathering in a wide pool under the bridge before flowing away in a thin river that cut through the narrow canyon, meandering out of sight toward the northern edge of the island. In the center of the bridge, missing boards left a gap a couple of yards wide. A large glass cube sat over the gap. I squinted, ignoring the elevated rush of my heart as I tried to figure out what it was and how it might relate to my second trial. I heard Kai swear under his breath, and Master Dalla hiss at him to be silent. The glass had a bluish sheen and was too thick to see through. I'd never seen... I drew in a breath and stopped. Not glass. Ice. Only a frostblood could create ice in this warm climate, shape and craft it so carefully, and I hadn't seen any frostblood since coming here, aside from the Queen's servant. Had he made this on her orders? Kai appeared at my side, speaking quickly.
"You can do this. You are ready. You just can't let yourself..."
"Silence," said Master Dalla.
"Remove your shoes and stockings."
I did so, dropping them beside the path. He motioned for me to approach the bridge.
"You see the chamber of ice?" he said quietly.
I swallowed convulsively and nodded.
"The ice will hold if you remain still and calm.
It's a test of restraint and endurance, control over your mind and body. Vital qualities in a master."
He pulled a small hourglass from a pocket and held it up. You must sit in the chamber for 1 hour, at which time you'll return here. If you move from that spot before I permit you to move, you will forfeit. I turned to stare at the pool of lava below. My fingernails bit into my palms, frustration already raising my temperature. I had never been able to repress my heat under stressful conditions. Brother Thistle had warned me that I needed to learn. Why hadn't I listened?
You may begin, said the master.
His face was a mask of indifference. How many young students had he watched die in tests like this? For a people with fire in their veins, it was such a cold way to measure its masters. And this trial in particular, a test of my ability to deny my very nature, seemed devoid of pity. I couldn't afford to get angry. Not now. I closed my eyes and took a deep breath, then started toward the bridge.
Stay calm, Kai instructed, grabbing my arm as I went to pass him. Don't get upset, no matter what happens. Think only of controlling the beat of your heart, of keeping your skin cool. Deep breaths.
He pulled me tight against him. I had a moment, pressed to his chest, to ponder the irony of his advice. He counseled me not to grow warm, not to worry. Meanwhile, I could feel his chest rising and falling rapidly against my cheek, his overheated skin, his heart thudding in my ear. His warm lips pressed hard against my forehead, and then he let go. I grasped the rope cables that ran like handles on both sides and stepped on the bridge. It was just wider than my shoulders, but sturdy under my bare feet. I followed it until I reached the center. A small opening allowed access into the ice chamber. I climbed in and slowly sat, crossing my legs. I wouldn't look down. Brother Thistle's lessons in mental control had never been so vital. Breath after breath, beat after beat of my heart, I sought the word he'd taught me and returned to it, trying to clear my mind. Without the freedom to coat myself in extra layers of warmth, I started to shiver. Several minutes passed before I realized that my legs weren't just cold, they were growing damp. The ice was melting. My heart stuttered and pumped faster. My fingers tingled with pings of heat. I took several shuddering breaths. Calm. Cold. Slow. Slow. I thought of Arcus. His cool skin, his command of his gift, his lessons on control. I struggled to master my responses, not to panic. Without deciding to, I looked down. Oh, Sood. Under the blur of ice, the orange of hot lava. How would this hold? How could it possibly... Stop. Focus. I squeezed my eyes shut and returned to the task at hand, slowing my heart. My breathing, keeping the heat at bay, ignoring the biting discomfort of the cold. The minutes crawled. When next I opened my eyes, I was sitting in a groove in the ice. My leggings were soaked. Still, I focused on the word, on not letting panic rule. The ice was melting quite slowly. If I could just keep myself as cool as possible, this would all be over and I would pass the test. I could do this. That's when I felt it. A vibration. On the bridge, small, dark blurs made a skittering sound. The minuscule spots rushed closer, growing in size. Mice? Rats? Spiders, perhaps? But no, not spiders. I'd seen an illustration of this creature in a book. It had 8 legs. But a segmented tail rose and curled forward over its back with a stinger on the end. Its front legs widened into hard pincers that could sever the body of an insect in half. They were bright orange and glowed with heat. My breath caught. Sudesian scorpions. They came with terrible speed, flowing forward over the ropes and boards of the bridge. When they reached the ice, they would have nowhere to go but inside, inside the tiny space where I sat, where any increase in temperature would mean melting and death. I started to struggle to my knees,
then remembered Master Dalla's instruction. I could not move. If I left the chamber, I would forfeit. Instead, I reached out, hoping this movement would not disqualify me, and set bolts of fire at the shapes. When the first one burned, the nearby scorpions reared and changed direction. If anything, they moved faster now. I burned another and another, then realized my mistake. One of the rope cables caught fire. I swore. How was I supposed to defend myself? But of course I wasn't. I was supposed to sit here calmly as these stinging beasts swarmed over me, helpless on a block of cruel ice that would melt if I allowed my fear to get out of control. Sage, I called desperately, but I didn't hear her or see her. I was alone. Even the presence of the Minax wouldn't be unwelcome now. I would use the darkness to burn those little creatures no matter where they ran, seeking out their tiny hearts with that warped but vivid certainty I always felt when I let the darkness rule. But there was nothing in my mind, no presence but my own. Frantically, I searched for some defense. Brother Thistle's teachings. But I couldn't calm myself in these conditions. I could barely remember the mental practice. What was the word? I couldn't even remember the... Something touched my knee and I lashed out unthinkingly with my fist. I screamed as pain lashed my thigh. The first scorpion had wasted no time in sinking its stinger onto my skin. I swore as another scorpion crawled up my back, hovering on my shoulder. I took a breath and tried to think. This was a test of self-control, so the test would be set up to punish me for movement and to reward stillness and calm. It stood to reason that if I remained still, they wouldn't sting. I tried to focus on breathing, but my breath came in sobs. All I could do was concentrate on keeping my mouth closed. If, sued forbid, one of them touched my mouth, I shuddered in disgust. More of the creatures poured into the space. They were small, not much bigger than my thumb, but they were fast, and several of them grasped my skin experimentally in their razor-like pincers. I moaned, shaking with the effort of remaining still. The groove in the ice was deeper now. I was sitting in a puddle. How long before my movements, my fear and anguish, melted a hole that would drop me into the stew below? But even though that was the greater threat, it was the scorpions that tormented me. Inside me, the heat was rising, my control slipping, my sanity unravelling. I was covered now. At least a dozen were in the chamber, scuttling and confused, crawling over me and over me in their desperation to find a way out. I breathed through my nose with shuddering breaths. When one attached itself to my neck, I jerked convulsively. They grew more agitated. Two more sank their stingers into my skin, one on my knee and another on my back. Tears slid down my cheeks and hissed as they landed in the cold puddle below. I closed my eyes. What a horrible way to die. I shook away the thought. The time had to be almost up, just a few more minutes. Some of the scorpions crawled out again, heading back the way they came. The fire I'd started on the rope deterred passage that way, but some of them chose the other rope. Finding no exit in the ice, they started to finally leave. I allowed myself a sigh of relief. And then the ice gave way. The first sign was the puddle draining away into a tiny opening that let the water flow down and out, as if a cork had been removed from a stopper. As the hole grew larger, I braced myself against the sides of the chamber with my arms, kneeling and widening my legs. Another scorpion stung the back of my hand, panicked by my movement, and then it fell, legs and tail moving with ponderous surprise, toward the lava below. The remaining creatures scuttled out of the chamber, all but one, which stayed tangled in my hair, its pincers driving into my scalp. The hole widened. I used my fingers to carve handles into the sides of the chamber. I couldn't sit any longer. The floor would soon be altogether gone. I watched as the opening widened, widened. It was hypnotic to see the ice turn to liquid and drip helplessly into the lava. If I dropped, I hoped it wouldn't take me long to die. Since fire coursed through my veins, sinking into the lava would be like going home.
in some way. That's what I told myself.
Hang on, Ruby, a voice called. Tears coursed down my face and dried instantly on my heels.